bring liveliness and activity to the routine of its residents. It also attracted the government's support, which has invested more than $4 million to turn the islands purple. World-renowned musician Yo-Yo Ma has transferred a COVID-19 vaccine waiting room to a concert hall in the U.S. city of Pittsburgh. Played the pieces after receiving a second dose of the coronavirus jab. Dozens of socially distanced people who had just received their second shot listened on at the Berkshire Community College while waiting for the 15-minute mandatory observation period to end. Yo-Yo Ma, who is a local resident, has said his performance was meant to give something back to the community.
Rations in the town of Yaryapolsky mark the end of winter with a colorful Maslenitsa celebration. People dressed in costumes march in the center of the town, which lies some 170 kilometers from Moscow. After some friendly competitions, participants burn the effigy of Maslenitsa. This marks the end of winter and was believed to fertilize the soil and bring a good harvest in the upcoming autumn.
The Maslenitsa went great. We have been sitting at home for a long time because of this COVID, but now everything is fine.
Maslenitsa is celebrated during the last week before the Christian festival of Lent. It is a last chance to the upcoming weeks to eat dairies and meat, which are forbidden in the upcoming fasting time. The festival began as a pagan ritual, but was later absorbed into the Russian Orthodox Christian tradition. That's a wrap up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
Harabi English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to Harabi English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Harabi English Radio.
In the limelight.
The bigger picture is that American lawmakers are using false narratives about protests, which have been overwhelmingly peaceful, to pass laws they hope will make many folks, including ones who seek to protest police violence, white supremacy, or climate change, to simply stay home, says Will Bunch, author, in an article published under the heading Republicans want to criminalize protest. Stay tuned for the details, please. The massive marches against racial injustice and police violence after 2020's killings of Taylor, George Floyd, and Aubrey, protests on Native American land against the Dakota Access Pipeline, and the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. Arguably, these three events have little in common with each other. except that now they have inspired some bad ideas and worse legislation in a number of state houses and on Capitol Hill. Most, although not all, from Republicans that would criminalize one of the most fundamental rights in an American democracy, to dissent against the government. The biggest gut punch to the American experiment came recently in Kentucky, which just recently marked the one-year anniversary of the senseless killing of Louisville Taylor, a 26-year-old ER technician who was gunned down in a police drug raid gone horribly wrong. It's bad enough that none of the responding officers has been charged in her death. But now state legislators in conservative Kentucky, which has seen continuous protests since the killing, have advanced a law of dubious constitutionality to make it illegal to say bad things to a police. The bill that the Kentucky Senate passed recently makes it a misdemeanor to taunt a police officer with words or gestures that would have a direct tendency to provoke a violent response from the perspective of a reasonable and prudent person. In the past, state juries and the U.S. Supreme Court have cited the First Amendment in finding that it's not a crime to say rude things or even curse at a police officer. But now, the bluegrass state is saying that if you flip the bird at a cop and he tries to bash in your skull, the whole thing was your fault. Although the anti-taunting the police provision garnered the most headlines, the Kentucky bill also expands the definition of illegal protest while strengthening the penalties for rioting and making it harder to get out of jail. And it even includes some vague language intended to thwart the defund the police movement. If the bill passes the state house and is signed by the state's Democratic governor Andy Beshear, an uncertain prospect, it would surely put more people behind bars for protesting the killing of Taylor than people who actually killed her. In a vacuum, this alone would be outrageous. But instead, after a decade in which more Americans protested more things, from Occupy Wall Street to Ferguson to the Women's March, the George Floyd protests, than any time since 1960s, the Kentucky scheme is just the most extreme example of a flurry of bills meant to criminalize your right to air your grievances against the government. A bill in Oklahoma, for example, would protect drivers who plowed their car into a crowd of protesters and make it illegal to post the information about law enforcement officers online, which, as critics noted, might criminalize videos like the ones that showed the world what happened to George Floyd. In Florida, Governor Ron DeSantis, considered a GOP presidential frontrunner for 2024 if Donald Trump doesn't run, is pushing legislation for steep felony sentences for those found to be rioting and to shield people who shoot protesters or run them over from lawsuits. The International Center for Not-for-Profit Law said recently that 23 states are considering 48 anti-protest bills so far in 2021. That includes four states looking to join 14 others that have declared oil and gas pipelines and other fossil fuel facilities as critical infrastructure, which would mean stricter penalties for protesting them, a movement that started after Dakota Access actions in 2016. Additionally, some leaders in both parties, even President Biden, are citing the January 6th assault on Capitol and calling for harsher penalties, including new laws against domestic terrorism. But critics say that even well-meaning efforts to quell certain kinds of dissent have a way of backfiring. But by using the domestic terrorism label to promote more criminal statutes and police authorities, our country's leaders are invoking systems that have been and will continue to be used to target and harm black and brown people, wrote Haina Shamsi, director of the ACLU's National Security Project, and Munar Wahid, ACLU Senior Legislative and Advocacy Council. The bigger picture is that even in a time of optimism over increasing coronavirus vaccines and a generous $1.9 trillion relief package signed by Biden, lawmakers are using false narratives about protests, which have been overwhelmingly peaceful, to pass laws they hope will make many folks, including ones who seek to protest police violence, white supremacy, or climate change, to simply stay home. Citizens in the affected states need to get out and fight these anti-democratic measures while they still can.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is John. Welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region of South Asia as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people. Please stay with us.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about reports of hype and panic in Pakistan over the repayment of a hefty loan to the United Arab Emirates. Then we explore the impacts of such a move on the economic situation of the debt-ridden country and the future of Imran Khan at the helm of a ship sailing through troubled seas.
In 2021, March was the cruelest month for Pakistan, with April yet to come. Mid-March was the deadline for the repayment of a big slice of a huge loan back to the UAE. Nobody would expect the so-called friend Abu Dhabi to ask for the whopping $1 billion. So the news of the Emirati move sent shockwaves across the country. Deposited with the State Bank of Pakistan, the amount has now reached its maturity, and draining such a volume of money can be the coup de grace for Premier Imran Khan.
Since Abu Dhabi asked Islamabad to repay a $1 billion chunk of its loan, which was due mid-March, there are unconfirmed and sometimes conflicting scenarios about the economic and political future of the country. The $1 billion loan was part of the $6.2 billion initial bailout that helped the government of Prime Minister Imran Khan to avoid default on international debt obligations back in late 2018. Islamabad says the main reason behind the delay in the return of the loan amount is the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic on its already weak economy. And it is true. According to the World Bank estimate, amid the pandemic, Pakistan's real GDP growth has shrunk. According to the State Bank of Pakistan, the foreign debt and liabilities of Islamabad have increased to a total of over $115 billion until December 2020. In addition to the colossal damage of such a move on the country's economy, it will have massive political consequences for Pakistan. Imran Khan is under extra pressure now, as its government has received about $7 billion in gross foreign loans itself in only in 2020 to 2021.
There are many reports saying that the top Pakistani officials have made repeated attempts to reach out to the Emirati Crown Prince, seeking a one-year extension to return the loan. Moreover, many people are certain of a rollover, and some believe that it is again China that will come to the rescue. However, none of the scenarios may lead to a more popular Imran Khan.
For a country like Pakistan, with multiple incidences of internal and external conflicts, Imran Khan has come to be a skilled sailor, since the seas of South Asian politics seldom see the calm. Earlier in March, the captain had to garner a vote of confidence from the lower house of parliament following a surprise electoral defeat on a Senate seat earlier in the week. Khan, who was elected to power in a general election in 2018, is the founder of Pakistan's Tehreek-e-Insaf party that leads a ruling coalition. The party experienced another boost when the Senate elected ruling alliance candidate Sadiq Sanjrani as the chairman of the upper house of parliament. Sanjrani, the incumbent whose candidacy was supported by Imran Khan, received 48 votes, with the opposition's Yusuf Raza Gilani receiving 42. Despite a relatively robust standing in domestic affairs of Pakistan, the fact that the United Arab Emirates has moved to withdraw financial support of Islamabad indicates a widening gap in their bilateral relations. Pakistan doesn't seem to have the money to give back. Therefore, even the prospects of losing such a loaded friend has the ability to induce panic in Pakistan's politics.
Last year, when Saudi Arabia announced a similar demand, Pakistan's all-weather friend China came to Imran Khan's rescue. Thanks to Beijing's handsome help, Pakistan paid back $1 billion out of the $3 billion loan that it had secured back in 2019 to avoid default. Now, many expect China to do another trick and get Pakistan to safe shores again. But why lend money to someone when you're sure of their inability to pay back?
Pakistan's economy is severely dependent on international support. This is why the country is deep in debts with almost no real possibility of payback. The financial assistance packages by Saudi Arabia and the UAE helped Pakistan to buy time to negotiate a deal with the International Monetary Fund, or the IMF. But the implementation of the IMF deal has been itself in limbo for over a year now.
Unfortunately, IMF has totally gripped the economy of Pakistan, and the country, Ministry of Finance and all the financial institutions are acting completely what the IMF want, because they have, I many times said this, that the IMF have first planted their people. They have given the positions in the current government. There are the key elements and the key figure of the Imran Khan government are the people who were the employees of the IMF previously. So right now, so it's mean that the country economy has been hijacked by IMF. And currently, the situation is getting worse and worse. And if the situation goes on, I think that the country is going towards some sort of the major bankruptcy.
Pakistan returned the Saudi loan by securing three different financing pipelines from China. Beijing gave Islamabad $1 billion as soft loan, a credit swap financing line of $1.5 billion and $500 million commercial loan from the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China. The Chinese assistance helped the State Bank of Pakistan maintain the gross foreign exchange reserves of around $13 billion. Currently, the Pakistani government is trying its best to revive the stalled IMF bailout program. As part of the IMF conditions, the government is amending clauses in the State Bank of Pakistan Act of 1956 on the definitions of the monetary liabilities of the central bank.
IMF has a plan that how to suck the blood of the people and how they will take all its control into the institutions, because this is a strategy. When IMF want to cripple the economy of any country, or they want to put the country towards a bankruptcy, they use such kind of the tactics. So similarly, if I will give you an example that how what's going on in Lebanon now, that their economy is moving towards the barter system. So that is horrible and alarming. So we can see the similar situation is going in Pakistan, because the major sectors of the economy who were the source and the revenue generation sources, they have almost finished. So in that condition, Pakistan economy has been handicapped by IMF by planting their own people into the Pakistani government.
A rollover may be able to postpone Islamabad's problem for some time, but the media frenzy over the UAE move was indicative of Pakistan's strategic significance in the geopolitical alignments of Asia and the entire world. Saudi and UAE pressure is pushing Pakistan towards China, as well as perhaps Iran and Turkey, something the United States and probably India never like. On the other hand, Washington needs Islamabad to keep its foothold in Afghanistan, which is itself getting closer and closer to China. Pakistan is a centerpiece in many of the regional puzzles that we have today.
The network of political alignments around Pakistan is complex, and any slight shifts can lead to big consequences. The recent row over the return of UAE's loan further proved the case. Pakistan is among the rare countries in the world with cordial ties with both China and the US. Washington needs it for better reach in Afghanistan, and Beijing needs it for access to the Indian Ocean. It is a good partner to its western neighbor Iran, but has a history of adversary against India, which in turn has historically friendly connections with Iran. Saudi Arabia and Iran can't get along together, but both value their relations with Pakistan. It does not seem to be about the money. By playing the money card, the UAE may be just mimicking Saudi gimmicks to threaten the government, force Pakistan into Israeli ties, or whatever manipulation they deem favorable. But no matter their objectives, unexpected changes in dynamic systems don't necessarily lead to favorable results.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to learn more about this, we are joined by Mr. Kamar Cheema. He's a strategic and political analyst. Mr. Cheema, welcome to this show. So, why has the UAE demanded repayment of its $1 billion loan back from the debt-ridden Pakistan? What does Abu Dhabi want to achieve other than its money?
Well, the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia has demanded the money back. The reason behind is that when they gave the money, obviously Pakistan was not thinking that there could be other things which the Emiratis and the Saudis may ask, and while Pakistan had to lose the financial autonomy was no more with Pakistan, so the Saudis and the Emiratis want to take away our autonomy regarding the foreign policy choices. So What we have learned through the sources is that the Pakistan has been asked to recognize Israel. So while the Pakistani government has decided not to recognize Israel because Pakistan's founding father, Qaid-e-Azam Muhammad Ali Jinnah, has made it clear long ago that we cannot recognize Israel and until and unless there is a two-state solution for that. So that was the reason that the Emiratis are trying to pressurize Pakistan, and it's just not the $1 billion which the Emiratis are demanding. The other challenge is that the visas have been banned for the Pakistanis. So the Pakistanis are unable to secure the position in UAE, which the other countries can secure. So this is a kind of a challenge that Pakistan had to face by not recognizing Israel. And we had to lose our foreign policy choices. We have been asked to compromise our foreign policy choices because of this.
Wow, really, something really astonishing. So you talked about Israel, of course, but is Abu Dhabi's move somewhere around removing Imran Khan from power? And will he survive such a political upheaval? What are his options?
Well, Abu Dhabi really doesn't want to remove Imran Khan from the power. He doesn't want this, and they will not try to micromanage in Pakistan's politics. They have not been doing it even in the past. But primarily, the choices for Imran Khan has reduced because when Imran Khan came in power, he had to go to the UAE and to the Saudi Arabia for asking money for the financial challenges we were facing. So, and that was the reason that even the International Monetary Fund gave money to Pakistan, that the Saudis and Emiratis were providing us some of the financial bailout plan. So they don't want Imran Khan to come go out of the power, but definitely they want that we should compromise on our foreign policy. For example, Pakistan didn't go to Malaysia when there was a session that was called by Mahathir Mohamad, the former Prime Minister of the Malaysia, to have a session parallel than the OIC. And at the same time, Pakistan has been asked to, that Pakistan is asking the Emiratis and the Saudis to call a special session of the foreign ministers of the Muslim countries so that they can talk on Kashmir. But unfortunately, rather calling that particular session, we have been facing challenges, and that challenges are that we have been asked to not to rely or not to depend on any kind of foreign policy bailout from the Emiratis and the Saudis.
Mr. Jima, our team has collected a few global media coverages in this regard, and I would appreciate if you could just take a look, and then we can continue. Thanks.
Earlier this year, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and Pakistan reached a staff-level agreement to release $500 million US as part of the larger loan pact. The year 2019 saw the international financial institution agreeing to provide a $6 billion US loan to the country to rein in the debt crisis in exchange for reform measures. The Pakistani currency hit over a one-year high at 156.99 rupees against the US dollar in the interbank market in mid-March, as flow of foreign currencies remained high compared to outflows. The inflows have kept the currency's foreign currency reserve stable at a 13-month high of $13 billion and strengthened Islamabad's capacity to make international payments mainly on import and foreign debt repayment counters. The analyst said the latest recovery in rupee was partially backed by the reports that the UAE would roll over soft loan worth $1 billion to Pakistan. Islamabad was scheduled to pay off the loan last Friday, March 12th, but the transaction did not take place. Pakistan has found itself in stronger standing with a Saudi-led bloc of Arab nations, having managed to mend a rift while maintaining ties with another alliance with Iran and Turkey that is challenging the Saudis' leadership of the Muslim world. After the Pakistan-Arab League rift emerged in August, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates asked Pakistan to repay $4 billion in loans taken out in 2018. Then in December, the UAE suspended the issuance of work visas to Pakistani nationals, a move experts said was designed to pressure Pakistan. Out of the committed $6.2 billion, the UAE disbursed $2 billion. It did not make the $3.2 billion oil financing facility and also withheld last $1 billion cash disbursements. Finance Ministry sources had told the Express Tribune that less disbursements by the UAE as against the commitments were because of Pakistan's decision to avail $500 million cash support from Qatar. The UAE has already rolled over $1 billion deposit for another year, which matured in January this year. Despite the drop in global remittances, two of the world's largest recipients of remittances, Pakistan and Bangladesh, registered a rise in flows in 2020 compared with 2019. Pakistanis working abroad sent home more than $2 billion for the eighth consecutive month in January 2021, with Saudi Arabia and the UAE emerging as the biggest contributors to the remittance inflows in recent months. UAE-Pakistan remittances in January 2021 was recorded at $2.3 billion, up by 19% from a year earlier, the country's central bank said. Pakistanis living and working in Saudi Arabia and the UAE contributed the highest inflows during from July 2020 to January 2021, amounting to $7.9 billion in total. A Saudi group that had originally bought the Karachi Electricity Supply Corporation, now called K-Electric, in 2005, has re-entered the scene amid an impasse over the future of the power utilities business relations with the government following the downfall of Arif Naqvi, the British-Pakistani businessman who was the founder and chief executive of the Dubai-based private equity firm, the Abraj Group. The owner of the Al Jomeh Holding Company of Saudi Arabia, Sheikh Abdul Aziz Hamid Al Jomeh, spent the day on separate meetings with President Arif Alvi, Prime Minister Imran Khan, Ministers for Finance, Energy and Privatization, and some other important stakeholders.
All right, welcome back, Mr. Chima. So, moving ahead, what are the economic and political consequences of removing such a huge amount from the Pakistani economy?
Well, first of all, it will have a direct impact on the foreign exchange reserve, which is very less at the moment. I think around $14 billion foreign exchange reserves are with the central bank. This is the first economic challenge we will face. Definitely, it will have a challenge for any foreign direct investment because if there is no money in the central bank, all the FDI, they keep on looking the macroeconomic indicators, and the government of Pakistan is trying to keep the macroeconomic indicators in a good position so that they can attract the foreign investors. So this is one thing which is definitely going to be a challenge when it comes to economics. But politically, it will have the impact that Pakistan's Kashmir policy has got weakened because Organization of Islamic Cooperation, and particularly the Saudis and the Emiratis, they are not supporting Pakistan on this particular issue of Kashmir. And since they believe that Pakistan is not taking care of their choices regarding recognizing Israel or making or having a starting a debate in Pakistan about the recognition of Israel, so why to listen to Pakistan on that? And above all, the Emiratis, we have been asked, not by anyone, but we have been asked by some of the quarters in the Middle East that we should not be as neutral as we are when it comes to Iran as well. So particularly, I believe that Pakistan's political choices will further be compromised because Pakistan wants to keep a position of neutrality in Middle East, particularly in the Saudi-Iran impasse.
Okay, Mr. Chima, the UAE's call happened only after a few months after a similar measure by Saudi Arabia. Are they connected?
Well, it seems that that there is some kind of a connection between the Emiratis and the Saudis on this, because personally, I find that the Saudis were not happy when Pakistan took a stance that Pakistan is not going to recognize Israel. So, and at the same time, we were not supporting the Emiratis and the Saudis on when they waged a war in Yemen, and Pakistan's parliament decided that we are not going to send the troops in Yemen and there will not be any boots on the ground. So this was a very turning point where the Emiratis were not very much happy on this, and somehow the GCC and these Arab countries, they try to have a unified policy on Pakistan, because Pakistan talks to all of these for a support on Kashmir issue. So and we wanted a collective support from the platforms like Organization of Islamic Cooperation and from the GCC, but unfortunately we couldn't. So there is some kind of a unity between the Saudis and the Emiratis.
Thank you so much, Mr. Shima. Unfortunately, it marks the end of our show. And thank you for your very commendable comments. People have voiced their opinion on social media and cyberspace. And let's just take a quick look.
Faisal Ali Shah said on his Twitter post, "Very challenging situation for Pakistan. UAE demands loan back at the same time as defense and others deal with agreements signed between Israel and UAE. Keep in mind, Pakistan is under pressure also to join Arab-Israel alliance against Iran." Mayank Jindal believes that UAE announces $10 billion fund for investments in Israel after a phone call between Mohammed bin Zayed and Netanyahu. Zayed says $1 billion will come from Pakistan as loan reimbursement and $9 billion will be scheduled investments. Tarun Khanna reacts on his Twitter account and says, "I wonder who will help Imran Khan to pay back the loans and which territory of Pak will be kept at stake." Mansi believes that UAE is behaving like an old Hindi film zamindar who just wants to have the poor farmer's land and house in return for the loan the farmer took from them. Muslim Brotherhood is dead, it seems. Poor Pakistan.
And that was our episode about the aftershocks of the UAE request for repayment of its big loan from Pakistan and the political dynamics of economic ties between Abu Dhabi and Islamabad. We shall meet next week.
The beginning of spring is finally here. Happy Nowruz! Happy the beginning of spring!
Happy Nowruz, dear Ringy New Year!
Nowruz reminds us that life continues and hope increases. Happy Nowruz! Happy the beginning of spring!
In the limelight.
In most cases, a person who gets vaccinated is protected from disease but not necessarily infection, says Deborah Fuller, researcher, in an article published under the heading, Can Vaccinated People Still Spread the Virus? Stay tuned for more. So you've gotten your coronavirus vaccine. Wait the 2 weeks for your immune system to respond to the shot and are now fully vaccinated. Does this mean you can make your way through the world like the old days without fear of spreading the virus? Deborah Fuller is a microbiologist at the University of Washington School of Medicine working on coronavirus vaccines. She explains what the science shows about transmission post-vaccination and whether new variants could change this equation. Does vaccination completely prevent infection? The short answer is no. You can still get infected after you've been vaccinated, but your chances of getting seriously ill are almost zero. Many people think vaccines work like a shield, blocking the virus from infecting cells together. But in most cases, a person who gets vaccinated is protected from disease, not necessarily infection. Every person's immune system is a little different, so when a vaccine is 95% effective, that just means 95% of people who receive the vaccine won't get sick. These people could be completely protected from infection, or they could be getting infected but remain asymptomatic because their immune system eliminates the virus very quickly. The remaining 5% of vaccinated people can become infected and get sick, but are extremely unlikely to be hospitalized. Vaccination doesn't 100% prevent you from getting infected, but in all cases, it gives your immune system a huge leg up on the coronavirus. Whatever your outcome, whether complete protection from infection or some level of disease, you will be better off after encountering the virus that if you hadn't been vaccinated. Does infection always mean transmission? Transmission happens when enough viral particles from an infected person get into the body of an uninfected person. In theory, anyone infected with the coronavirus could potentially transmit it, but a vaccine will reduce the chance of this happening. In general, if vaccination doesn't completely prevent infection, it will significantly reduce the amount of virus coming out of your nose and mouth, a process called shedding, and shorten the time that you shed the virus. This is a big deal. A person who sheds less virus is likely to transmit it to someone else. This means to be the case with coronavirus vaccines. In a recent preprint study, which has yet to be peer-reviewed, researchers tested 2,897 vaccinated people for signs of coronavirus infection. Most had no detectable virus, but people who were infected had one quarter the amount of virus in their bodies as unvaccinated people tested at similar times post-infection. Less coronavirus means less chance of spreading it, and if the amount of virus in your body is low enough, the probability of transmitting it may reach almost zero. However, researchers don't yet know where that cutoff is for the coronavirus, and since the vaccines don't provide 100% protection from infection, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, recommends that people continue to wear masks and social distance even after they have been vaccinated. what about the new coronavirus variants? New variants of coronavirus have emerged in recent months, and recent studies show that vaccines are less effective against certain ones, like the B1351 variant first identified in South Africa. Every time SARS-CoV-2 replicates, it gets new mutations. In recent months, researchers have found new variants that are more infective, meaning a person needs to breathe in less virus to become infected, and other variants that are more transmissible, meaning they increase the amount of virus a person sheds. And researchers have also found at least one new variant that seems to do better at evading the immunity system, according to early data. So how does this relate to vaccines and transmission? For the South Africa variant, vaccines still provide greater than 85% protection from getting severely ill with COVID-19. But when you count mild and moderate cases, they provide at best only about 50% to 60% protection. That means at least 40% of vaccinated people will still have a strong enough infection and enough virus in their body to cause at least moderate disease. If vaccinated people have more virus in their bodies and it takes less of that virus to infect other persons, there will be higher probability a vaccinated person could transmit these new strains of the coronavirus. If all goes well, vaccines will very soon reduce the rate of severe disease and death worldwide. To be sure, any vaccine that reduces disease severity is also at the population level, reducing the amount of virus being shed overall. But because of the emergence of new variants, vaccinated people still have the potential to shed and spread the coronavirus to other people, vaccinated or otherwise. This means it will likely take much longer for vaccines to reduce transmission and for populations to reach herd immunity than if these new variants had never emerged. Exactly how long that will take is a balance between how effective vaccines are against emerging strains and how transmissible and infectious these new strains are.
Economic divide.
Hello and welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kava Tahwai. In this week's show, we will be looking at Russia and how the recent tensions with the EU have pushed Russia east towards China. The Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov said, "We're ready for that," in reference to Russia breaking ties with the EU. He even said, "If you want peace, prepare for war." The consequence for this type of approach, well, it risks the Russian economy to go downwards, including in the most sensitive areas. Since the annexation of Crimea in 2014, EU economic sanctions have targeted Russia's financial, defense, and energy sectors. Russia has responded with counter-sanctions, banning around half of its agri-food imports from the bloc. Well, EU leaders unanimously decided to extend the sanctions until the 31st of July 2021. The measures, which are renewed twice a year, have hit Russia hard. By late 2018, its economy was thought to be 6% lower in terms of its GDP output due to EU and U.S. sanctions. Let's now look into our first report that studies the trade relation between the EU and Russia and how Russia does not need to look towards Europe for economic connectivity and new ideas.
The warning was a severe one.
Russia warned the EU that it would cut ties over economic sanctions. Russia accused the EU that three of its diplomats had attended an illegal pro-Navalny protest. Russia's opposition leader, Alexei Navalny, has been a vocal critic of the Russian President Vladimir Putin, and the EU has slammed Russia for jailing him.
And for the first time, last week on Monday, we decided to implement sanctions because of the Navalny case. It means that we are totally committed and we are united in Europe in order to be very tough, very firm, in order to promote our values, to defend our interests.
Well, obviously, this represents a very serious escalation in tensions between Russia and the European Union. And the backdrop to all of this is, of course, the pandemic and the massive economic and social and political strain that's putting both on Russia and upon the European Union. Now, of course, EU leaders say that this is about Navalny in Russia and the crackdown on democratic dissent and so on. I think most people can see that this is hypocritical.
Russia-EU trade relations will surely deteriorate even further now that both will trade sanctions. But how low can this relationship go? The European Union and Russia have an important bilateral trade relation. Russia is the EU's fifth largest trading partner, and the EU is Russia's largest trading partner. The trade value between the two is valued at 232 billion euros for the year 2019. In 2019, Russia was the origin of 40% of EU imports of gas and 27% of EU imports of oil. Due to the large value of these imports, EU's trade deficit with Russia is only second to EU's trade deficit with China. Taking a look at imports and exports, the main EU exports to Russia are in the categories of machinery, transport equipment, medicines, chemicals, and other manufactured products. Meanwhile, the main EU imports from Russia are raw materials, especially oil like crude and refined gas, as well as metals, notably iron, steel, aluminum, and nickel.
Joining me in the studio is current affairs and impact analyst Mahan Abedin. We also have Mark Sloboda, a Moscow-based international affairs and security analyst. He provides security and geopolitical analysis to various media outlets, and as a political risk consultant, he also operates in that capacity. Okay, I'd like to welcome you both. Mark Sloboda, first to you. Russia heading for a break is what the news says with the EU. The Russian foreign minister, his quote, "We're ready for that. If you want peace, prepare for war." He said that a break in ties could be triggered by EU sanctions, and that will create risk for the Russian economy, including in the most sensitive areas. What does this mean when it comes to the economies of both Russia and the EU, and the impact of this break were it to occur?
Okay, so Lavrov's comments about the potential for a break with the EU come in the context of the EU discussing new sanctions, yet another sanctions package to level against Russia over the affair with the fringe far-right Russian ultranationalist Alexei Navalny, who is pretty much openly supported by Western media and intelligence services. Russia draws a severe difference between the EU and the individual member states of the EU in Europe.
Okay, it sounds an awful lot like what Trump used to say about the EU and the individual countries. Well, Mahan, relations between the EU and Russia are at a low, another low. And you have sanctions that have been exercised, the case of Navalny basically being the push there. It seems there's no escaping it, that the sanctions is bringing Russia to a point where it needs to decide how it's going to still be bound to the sphere of the EU in terms of trade, for example. Does the EU, given how badly it's in need of an economic boost with the way that it's suffering from the COVID-19 cumulatively, can it afford to actually lose a trading partner like Russia?
Well, in short, no, because the EU is undergoing tremendous problems. I mean, Brexit is one of them, the UK leaving. The UK was a huge part of the EU, especially from a defense and security point of view. It was really the only country that had weight and punch on the international stage, France excepting, perhaps. So there's the UK issue, there's schisms and its own centrifugal forces. Look, this vaccination rollout is a prime example of how the EU cannot cope with a major crisis.
Thank you for that. Now we're going to take a look at the next report that's coming up. which in this case is going to focus on the way that the EU has been doing with respect to Russia, of how Russia is actually being pushed into perhaps China's side, but how at the same time Ken brings about the question how Russia, whether Russia can actually lose the EU as a trading partner. We'll also examine the U.S. role in the way that it's demonized Russia to stop the close EU trade link with Russia.
Vladimir Putin unmasked. Shock claim Kremlin will do anything to break up the EU. Headlines similar to this have made the rounds in the news. But why would the Russian President Vladimir Putin want the breakup of the EU? Take this entry by the BBC, which paints a picture that Vladimir Putin is using hybrid warfare to destabilize Europe.
Is Vladimir Putin using hybrid warfare to destabilize the EU? Hybrid warfare can refer to any form of aggression short of open invasion.
From the perspective of the EU, what they are fundamentally worried about is the breakdown of what used to be called the unipolar world. So a world where the United States was overwhelmingly hegemonic, both in economic and military terms, and likewise its allies, like the European Union bloc, were, you know, the only show in town when it came to global geopolitics.
Clarify matters, Russia has said that it wants closer ties with friendly EU states. But when it comes to the EU and Russia, it's all about trade. On the one hand, Russia does not want to be bound to the EU's bloc's trading rules, yet it does want to trade with EU countries where its interests are concerned. But it is the US that has played a factor in forming an anti-Russia stance, dragging the EU along with it. The perfect opportunity presented itself with the 2014 Russian annexation of Crimea and Moscow's role in the conflict in eastern Ukraine.
Back with me in the studio is Mahan Abedin and Mark Sloboda. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Mark Sloboda, Russia not too keen on the European Union. It has said that it is part of the Eurasian Economic Union at the same time, which may be somewhat of a competition. The prospect of closer ties, however, between Moscow and Beijing has worried many analysts in the U.S. and also the EU. A new poll has found Russians are far more actually upbeat about their eastern neighbors than those to their west. Is Russia more gravitated economically, you think, to the east, or does it want to find a fine balance between the two when it comes to trade?
Yeah, so I think that requires some specification. Russia, I agree, is not keen on the EU as an institution, but it still is trying and hopes for better relations with the individual member states of Europe that are part of the EU, you know, principally Germany, France, you know, but others as well. And China is still Russia's largest state trading partner by a significant amount, with trade in the last year between the two totaling some $50 billion in U.S. dollar terms. But collectively, if you view the countries of Europe as one within the EU, then that biggest trading partner would still be the EU. So Russia still does do significant trade with the EU and is, or the, its members, and is loath to see these relations further damaged, particularly on economic terms.
Well, it appears that there is a difference here in the figures that has been presented. It is now said that Russia, Mahan, is actually doing more trade with China, upwards to around $100 billion is what is projected for this current year that we're in. So that would put China to be the number one partner. However, let's take a look at the foreign policy of the EU and the West. I don't know if you agree with this, in particular when I say West, the U.S., whether that has prevented from the two forging ties with Russia. In other words, you have the EU and the U.S. maybe on one side, and since they are aligned, so to speak, when it comes to their approach to Russia, that perhaps then that together combined, they may be then imposing restrictions, i.e. sanctions, onto Russia. Do you think there's an alignment there, and this China-Russia alliance, do you think will further then be forged closer as you get the U.S. and the EU on one corner?
Yeah, well, first of all, on the issue of trade, you're right, China is a huge trading partner for Russia, but the quality of trade is important too. It's Russia's energy supplies, its gas, for instance, is mostly going to the EU, and that's very, very important.
Thanks to both Mahan and Mark Sloboda. Right now, we're about to take a short break here on Economic Divide.